In the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. In the kingdom of the paranoid, the one-eyed man is a spy. This is Paranoid Planet.
I welcome this kind of examination because people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
Esta nunca ha sido dictadura, señores. Esta es dicta blanda.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Our enemies are innovative and resourceful, and so are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
I don't like them putting chemicals in the water that turn the friggin' frogs gay.
I'm not going to give you a question. You are fake news.
Silent Green is people!
Welcome to bonus episode 6.5 of Paranoid Planet. I am your host, Michel-Jacques Gagné, recording this program from the top of the Ferris wheel in Old Orchard Beach, Maine. A short drive away from just about every location where a child was brutally murdered by a crazy clown in a Stephen King novel. Speaking of crazy clowns, my faithful co-host and producer, Juan Daniel Lijo, is not here with me today. He's in Chile, where he is, presumably, hunting down fascists. Or maybe he's somewhere in the amusement park below me, running into the maze of mirrors to save some unfortunate child from the fangs of an evil jester.
Hey! Hey, kid! Kid! Oh, 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 sorry. Hey! Oh, excuse me. Hey! Oh, 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 oh.
I'm here to help.
Stop following me.
I'm gonna get you out of here. No. Please.
Yeah, well, good luck with that. Now, when I say the words amusement park, what sort of image does that evoke in your mind? Some of your fondest childhood memories? Or the scene at the end of National Lampoon's Vacation, where the Griswolds find out Wally World is closed for repairs? Or that scene in Zombieland where Woody Harrelson mows down 400 zombies so Jesse Eisenberg can finally make out one last time with Emma Stone?
Time to nut up or shut up.
Or maybe that other scene, you know, the one in Final Destination 3 where everybody suffers a gruesome death on the roller coaster? Not once, but twice? Well, if you're anything like me, a teacher and father of two with a particularly thin vacation budget, my guess is that you've had many recurring nightmares of horrible vacation traffic, overpriced hotels, cheating carnival games, gut-wrenching rides that cost you a second mortgage, and the jarring impact of deep-fried foods clogging your arteries and pummeling your gallbladder. In this episode, we'll take you on a family road trip to Old Orchard Beach, Maine, or as we call it here in Quebec, Olochibi. I know that I told you on the last episode that that episode would be the last episode of our road trip episodes through the United States of Paranoia. You still following me? But I didn't want all of you New Englanders out there to feel ignored. So come along with us as we head to the beach, eat every kind of deep-fried tidbits imaginable, fight off crazy clowns, try to survive the rickety roller coaster, and talk about fear and conspiracy theories with some other vacationers and some locals, as well as Toby Ball, the host of the Strange Arrivals podcast. So join us, if you dare, on a mind and stomach-blowing all-American beachfront vacation. Because if you don't, we'll send Chevy Chase to your house and tell him to, well, just be himself. So don't say we didn't warn you.
Thank you. one's here. First one's here. First one's here.
Sorry, folks, we're closed for 2 weeks to clean and repair America's favorite family fun park. Sorry.
What?
Clark, what are you doing?
We watch his program. We buy his toys, we go to his movies. He owes us. Doesn't he owe us? Huh? He owes the Griswolds, right? Fucking A, right, he owes us.
Clark, you're scaring me.
Don't be scared. I just think somebody owes us an explanation, that's all.
Let's just find a hotel. I'll call my parents, they'll wire us some money. We can fly home and forget this entire vacation ever happened.
Honey, just relax, okay? I told you I'm not angry anymore. I'm in complete control. I'm sure they're not repairing every ride at the same time. I think they owe us a little explanation. I think they owe us a little fun, okay?
Sorry, folks, park's closed. The moose out front should have told you.
Yes, we're here to see Mr. Roy Wally.
What is your name, sir?
Clark W. Griswold.
What's this regarding, Mr. Grizzle?
We're here for public amusement relations, or this is a summer inspection to a personal matter.
Ah. Well, nobody notified this office of anything.
Well, I'm notifying you.
I'm afraid I'm going to need a little more than that, sir.
Okie dokie. How's this?
Clark, have you lost your mind? Where did you get that?
Sporting goods store, honey. Now you listen to me, fat ass. You do what I say and there won't be any problem, okay? Okay. We just drove 2,460 miles just for a little Roy Wally entertainment. The moose says you're closed. I say you're open.
We're not really violent people. This is our first gun.
Chapter 1, We're All Gonna Die.
We're all gonna die!
The first things you notice when you enter Old Orchard Beach in July is the busy flow of tourists, the five square blocks of traffic mayhem, the smell of fried food, popcorn, and sea air, and, of course, the small and overcrowded amusement park. The second thing you notice is that this is no Six Flags resort, and that the rides were probably built during the Eisenhower administration, which means that your bloody corpse might just end up making the 6 o'clock news. But hey, that's all part of the thrill, isn't it?
Here you go. Yeah, let's do it, baby.
Woo! We have to get off of here. No, don't push the button, don't push the button. Wait. Let me out.
Wind, it's all right. Jesus.
No, it's gonna crash.
Wendy?
The hydraulics will rupture, the dragons will collapse, please!
Hey, let me out!
Nobody else gets off this ride!
Dude, let me off!
So high school. Just out.
Hey! Ho.
Calm down!
Get out of here!
Go!
Hey.
Go!
Let's go!
Let me out!
Hey. Ho! Let's go! Hey!
Dude.
Ho! Let's go! Hey! Ho! Let's go! Hey!
Here we go!
Ho. Let's go! Hey! Ho!
What's your name, young man?
Sean Danielle.
And what's about to happen right now?
We're about to go on the Sea Viper in the Old Orchard Beach.
In Old Orchard Beach. Are you worried?
Kind of stressed.
I'm worried because about 8 years ago, I took your older sister here, and she broke a tooth when her face hit the... What do you call this thing here?
The bar.
The metal bar. Yeah, the so-called protection bar. You ready to go?
Yeah.
I'm going to record you screaming. I love you too.
No!
So I'm here in front of the Riptide at the Palace Pailand with a lady who seemed to have almost as much excitement as she could handle. What's your name?
Tammy Ballou.
Tammy, where are you from?
Maine.
You're from Maine, so you like to hang out at Old Orchard Beach, not...
We're from New Hampshire, but we're staying up here for the summer.
Okay. And did you enjoy the Riptide?
We did.
Yeah? Yeah. On a scale of 1 to 10, how close were you to losing your dinner?
Probably 9.
And have you done this before?
No.
Will you ever do it again?
No.
How would you compare this to one of the most scariest things you've done in your life?
Wasn't too scary. It was just the milkshake effect.
Okay, so it's not like giving birth or anything?
Oh, no, no.
That was a cakewalk.
That was a cakewalk.
Okay. Well, my show's about conspiracy theories. I'm going to ask you, what conspiracy theory do you think is most likely to be true?
Well, I don't...
Do you think the CIA killed Kennedy?
Yes.
Yes. Do you think there's a Sasquatch?
No.
No. Do you think that aliens are visiting our planet?
Yes.
Have you seen any?
No.
No. What do you think they would look like if we saw them?
Well, we go out to Colorado to visit his brother, and they have little pictures everywhere out there. So, yeah, they're green with big eyes.
Of course, Colorado legalized weed before everyone else. You think that has anything to do with it?
It might be. It might be. All right.
Well, thanks a lot. You can go and rest and have some aspirin.
Thank you.
You were on the cliffhanger and you look a little bit scared. So how was your experience?
It was fun. It was a little dizzying.
Yeah.
And, you know, listening, trying to get my son to, you know, do loosen up a little bit.
Has he loosened up?
A little bit. We're going to go do the roller coaster.
The roller coaster. Have you tried the was it cannabis edibles they have up the street?
No.
Okay. You don't want him to
try.
You don't want him to unwind that much. Right?
No. I tried slipping him a Benadryl, but he caught me.
Okay, I see. So where are you from?
From Bangor, Maine.
Bangor, Maine. And what brings you to Old Orchard Beach?
Our first family vacation.
Since the beginning of COVID or ever?
Oh, ever.
Ever?
Ever.
Like, wow. That's like what? Yeah. How old are your boys?
14 and 15.
14.
I'm 15 now.
Okay.
Sorry, his birthday is today.
Happy birthday. What's your name?
Alex.
Did you enjoy the cliffhanger as much as she did?
Nope, I felt like it was all insecure. I felt like it was going to fall off and I was going to fall off.
I heard a lot of creaking. I think that's what your mom was screaming about.
I think they should have oiled that or just make it more secure. Like, they didn't tell us how to get on it, so I was kind of afraid about that.
Okay. But you're okay now?
Yeah. I'm trying to leave my friend Dylan right here that the ride is not safe.
It was right. So between this ride and being abducted by aliens, which one do you think would be scarier?
I don't care about aliens. But I know what there is an alien of. You know what worms are, right?
Worms? Like the ones in the ground?
Yeah. Do you know they have no limbs, but they have their mouth and their butt is the same thing? I'm thinking those things are aliens.
Worms are aliens because their mouths and their butts look the same.
No, they are the same, and their gender is neutral. That means they're both male and female.
Does that make it hard for you to sleep at night?
I know there's different species of worms, like glove worms that shoot out their stomach and like can attack you.
How what's the biggest worm that could exist, and why should I be concerned about that?
Well, the biggest worm would probably be way underground where we are right now. Worms can get bigger up to around... probably bigger than we even know. They could be like giant worms down in the ground and we don't even know it.
Have you ever seen the movie Tremors?
No.
Mom, you've seen that?
Yes.
Yeah. What do you think he would do if he saw the movie Tremors?
He would never go outside again. Yeah. We just started fishing last year and he won't touch the worms.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds to me like you got some work to do. All right. So have a great time. Enjoy your rest of your time in Old Orchard Beach. What do you think is the worst thing that I could possibly eat here?
Probably lobster off a boat that comes in late.
You think it's, oh, because it's kind of gone off.
Probably.
Okay, I'll remember to stay away from those. Thanks a lot. Take
care. You're welcome. Thank you.
I'm talking to
Ella.
Ella and
Evan.
Evan and
Blake.
Blake, where are you guys from?
We're all from Rhode Island.
Rhode Island. So you came a really long way to come here.
Yeah, long for us. Yeah.
So you had to drive north to come here, right? Because
yeah.
I am Canadian, but I know where Rhode Island is.
Okay.
Do you know where Ontario is?
Somewhere in Canada.
Somewhere in Canada. It's about 500 times the size of Rhode Island.
Holy I figured.
Oh, you figured. Okay, so what brings you to Old Orchard Beach?
Family comes on vacation every
family
year.
Vacation? You're all a part of the same family?
Yeah.
Brother, sister?
She's my girlfriend.
She's your girlfriend.
Yeah.
Okay. I was going to say, if she was your sister, you could do a lot better. No, I'm just kidding. You're a lovely young lady. But I'm an old fart, so I'm not allowed to notice. What do you guys like most about Old Orchard Beach?
Just the atmosphere, you know, like the rides, the beach. And we stay at Seaview Inn every year, and it's really nice there. So
yeah?
Like that, yeah.
Is there HBO there?
No, there's like
I don't
not,
think
no,
so.
There's just
not
cable.
Many channels.
Couldn't even watch the Red Sox last night.
Couldn't watch the Red Sox. Yeah, it was brutal.
Oh, that's horrible. Could you drink?
No.
No?
Trust me, your parents won't listen to this. They don't know what podcasts are.
No,
you can tell them.
We couldn't. We seriously couldn't.
All right. So where would a guy like me go and find have a good time in Old Orchard Beach?
The Tiki Bar. Somewhere on the pier, right? The Brunswick.
Yeah. What's at the Brunswick?
I don't know. I've never been.
It's a patio bar with live music.
Oh, that's where his parents go. And they come back like raging drunk.
Yeah.
Okay. And what do you guys do while you're waiting for the parents to sober up?
Yeah, we chill by the beach, chill by the pool, play cards. A lot of family stuff.
A lot of family stuff. That's good. All right. No running around, no hanky-panky?
No, not really.
No. Is he behaving himself?
Mostly.
All right. Keep your hands to yourself, buddy. Your parents might not be here, but Jesus is watching.
Yes.
Complete the following phrase. Donald Trump is?
An asshole.
The best president of all time.
Oh, we have a debate here. Question number two, complete the phrase. Hillary Clinton is?
Crazy. Scandalous.
Always let the girlfriend answer first.
Scandalous.
I don't know. I don't have an answer.
Do you think she kidnaps children and holds them hostage in the basement of a pizzeria in Washington, D.C.?
I think that's a little far-fetched. So no.
It wouldn't surprise me, really.
No, it wouldn't surprise you? Why?
She's Hillary Clinton, you know? That's just her, you know?
I actually went to the Comet Ping Pong like 3 weeks ago, and it turns out there's no basement.
Well, that's a good thing, right?
Or at least they told me there was no basement.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
All right, let's continue. Justin Trudeau is?
I don't know who that is.
I don't know who that is. He's the Prime Minister of Canada. We wish we didn't know about him either. Okay, what is the greatest existential problem to the United States? This is a multiple choice question. Is it A, abortion, B, guns, C, identity politics, D, deep fried Oreos, E, it says here your mother-in-law, but basically your future mother-in-law, maybe, or crazy clowns?
I'm going to say abortion right now.
Abortion is the greatest existential. If you're a fetus, it's an existential crisis, I'm pretty sure. Yeah. If you're a pregnant teenager, then maybe it's a 50-50 coin toss, right? Okay. What would you say?
I would say guns.
Guns. Do you own guns?
No.
Do you like guns?
Not in certain circumstances.
Dogs. Have you ever fired a gun?
No.
Because I heard it could be quite a rush.
I'm sure it would.
Now, let's say hypothetically you had to fire a gun.
Okay.
You had to shoot someone with really busy hands, and he wasn't playing ball, and you knew he was an existential danger to you and your dignity as a young lady. Mm-hmm. Which weapon of choice would you prefer to teach this hypothetical person sitting beside you a lesson?
What do you mean? Which one? Like a gun or a knife or a...
Yeah, let's widen the scope and say any kind of weapon available in an American black market or legal market for that matter.
In that, I would use a gun. Yeah.
You would use a gun. Mm-hmm. All right. Sawed off? Shotgun?
I don't know.
Whatever protects
you. Gun. AR-15?
Not that serious. Like a handgun, probably.
Probably. Something
all right.
Like
all right.
That.
You kind of shoot him in the foot and tell him to back off first.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Before you shot him in the face.
Well, if a conversation and me smacking couldn't stop it, then yeah.
Okay.
Guns would be the last resort.
Last resort. First, a good slap. And then kind of like little daggers in your eyes. And then the gun.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. So you remember, if the slap is coming, just remember the gun is not far behind. Okay, all right. Next question. Which of the following places is not a town in Canada?
Another multiple choice question. A, moose jaw. B, south porcupine. C, Petawawa. D, medicine hat. E, St. Louis du Haha. Or, what am I, F, Beaver Trail Junction.
I'm going to say E.
E is St. Louis du Haha?
Yeah.
That actually exists. It's in Quebec. Yeah.
I say Beaver Trail Junction.
Beaver Trail Junction.
Trail Junction.
Yeah, that doesn't sound right, does it? What about the boyfriend?
B?
You say whatever she said.
Pretty much, yeah.
There you go. Hey, two right answers. That's pretty good. Okay, last questions. Are Americans paranoid?
Some, yes.
Yeah. I think it depends on where you're from.
You mean Texas? Let's face it, they're not here, you can say it.
not even the state, just like what town you're from. Like it and how you grew up. Like, I don't think it has to do with the area. Okay. I mean, it has a little to do, but I think it's how you brought up and the environment around you.
So which region or state in particular do you think, I'm not going there because that's where the crazies live.
The South.
All of the South.
All of it, just certain, like the Deep South.
The Deep South. How deep are we talking about here? Like the deep fried South.
Yeah.
And what about you?
Probably Florida.
Florida, that's where the crazies are?
People down there, yeah.
Is DeSantis crazy?
No, DeSantis is, he's a smart guy. He's a little crazy, but...
Okay, if DeSantis and Trump got in a fight, who would you be rooting for?
Yeah, probably right now DeSantis,
Okay. If AOC and Hillary Clinton got in a fight, who would you be rooting for?
No comment.
No comment. Okay. How about Bernie Sanders and Judge Thomas?
Judge Thomas, the Supreme Court guy?
He's the Supreme Court guy.
He's
the conservative black man.
Yeah.
Yes, Clarence Thomas. Yes,
cool.
Clarence. You're on a first name basis with him.
No. I've seen his, when I see the full name, I always think of, okay. I think he would beat Bernie Sanders.
You think he would beat Bernie Sanders?
I do.
Why? Because he's a brother?
No. He just seems less old.
What do you think about Canada?
I want to go to Canada because I've heard you can see like the Aurora Borealis really good from there.
You got to drive very, very far, but yes.
Yeah, so Canada's great for that.
Okay, Aurora Borealis, you, Canada, yes or no, and why?
I'd go to Canada. I don't know if I live in Canada, but I want to visit there. But I live in Rhode Island just because that's where my family and friends are from.
How old are you?
I'm 17.
You're 17. The drinking age in Quebec is 18.
And 18.
A lot of times you can get carded. Oh, you're dating a young... Ooh, you're a cougar.
Yeah. I am a cougar.
Okay. So I'm thinking Montreal road trip for your 18th?
Probably, yeah.
And you want to say something to represent the right wing of the table?
I would never live in Canada. It's too cold up there.
Too cold?
Yeah. Rhode Island...
Bunch of communists?
Yeah. Rhode Island's... Yeah.
Socialized medicine?
All right, real quick. Rhode Island's good, but once I'm like 50 and retired and rich, I'm moving down to probably like South Carolina. I'm gonna live my life.
You were gonna say Florida, West Palm? Or are we talking about like you're gonna be shacking up with your man Trump?
No.
My mom has a condo in West Palm Beach. I'm sure you can hang out there for a while.
Sure, if you want me to.
Okay, I'll let her know.
All right.
Okay, take care. Bye bye.
Thank you.
She didn't know I was taping her, but that was my stepsister, Sonia, and I'm here with my other stepsister, Julie, both of whom spent a lot of time at Old Orchard Beach as kids. I wouldn't call them my evil stepsisters, although sometimes I'm not sure if they're completely sane. So, hi, Sonia.
Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Julie.
Hello.
So, tell me a little bit about what Old Orchard Beach means to you.
Childhood memories. My parents used to take us every summer to go and see our family, and we would sleep in the van, me and my sister and I, just waiting for Dad and Mom to wake up around 5, just drive, and we were so excited just to see the ocean, see our family, and just wanted to come to the pier, buy Old Orchard t-shirts, and it was just a good time with our family.
We're here in the, what is it called, the Palace Play? Playland. This is a place you visit a lot as a kid. So, Julie, what does this place mean to you?
Ben, moi, je peux te parler en français?
No. They won't understand.
Okay. So this, like my sister said, the family was my dad's cousin and his wife and their kids. And we used to come here, leave early. We would leave at 4 in the morning, be half asleep from around Montreal, Vaudreuil-Dorion, still sleeping in the vehicle. And then we would get here around lunch. As soon as I would look outside and I would see the pebbles and the sand in the street, I knew we were around the place. And just walking down, we rented a few times a little cottage near the pier. And this, is, like, I didn't need Hollywood, Los Angeles, anything big. Just this place, smelling Lisa's pizzas, was just amazing. The Pirate's Cove mini putt is also one of the best memories. It's just so much fun.
Sonia, describe to us a little bit what this place looks like for people who have never been here.
But it's just like a regular like country fair with a lot of rides and games where you lose your money because they're rigged, and a lot of fried stuff that you'd never imagine eating.
So we have our conspiracy here. The games are rigged. Which one do you think is the most rigged?
All of them.
All of them. Judy had a favorite one that doesn't seem to be here anymore.
Was that you?
Oh, that was you.
Whack-a-mole, that wasn't rigged.
No.
That was just skills, which I had.
So why did they remove the whack-a-mole? Is that a conspiracy?
I guess because they gave me too many teddy bears.
Too many teddy bears. Did you get the pink elephant?
I did.
You did. We have an inside joke with the pink elephant. You'll have to listen to the podcast.
Okay.
It involves Liam Neeson and a guy losing his hand.
Okay.
Judy, what was your favorite ride or game?
I didn't play games very much because we weren't very much allowed to lose money in those games. But I remember just going on the big, big slides that were really like oversized. That was much fun. And the aunt kind of, not haunted, but like the fun house, crazy house that was in Montreal before.
Yeah.
So that was one of the landmarks for me.
So Montreal's parks sell their old garbagey rides to Old Orchard Beach.
At a discount. Probably at a discount price.
Because they're a little bit out of date and maybe needing some maintenance.
Well, just a good coat of paint can do the job sometimes.
Okay, all right. Now, how many young teenage boys in your day would you say you've kissed in this particular park?
Oh, none, because I was always with mom and dad, so...
Oh, really?
Same for me. Same. Boring.
Weren't mom and dad nudists?
Well, not here.
Oh, it was somewhere else.
Yeah.
Okay,
not at the Chochobee Beach.
Okay, all right. So what is the scariest thing that can happen to somebody at Old Orchard Beach?
Falling off a ride?
Does that happen a lot?
Oh, nothing scary can happen here. It's just lots of people having fun. It's like a big, big party, the whole city, the whole area. It's like one happy party, that's it.
The scariest thing is Elvis at the corner.
I think he's pretty cool. I chatted with him. We're going to have to go back and see him. Okay, one last thing. What are you most excited to do tonight?
Eat a pickle.
That's a fried pickle, right?
Deep fried Oreos. I didn't know they could deep fry Oreos and deep fried Twinkies and... deep fried cookie dough. Okay, we're trying that all at once.
We'll have a taste off of all the deep fried stuff that Americans put in their mouths.
Woohoo!
All right.
Chapter 2, Beach Armchair Food Critics.
Inside that basket are four items.
Mm.
You have 10 minutes to consume two of those items. Let's see what you have here. We have some fly shakes. A super worm hot dog and 100-year-old deviled eggs. Rotten squid lemonade.
We have
rotten tuna fish with maggots. And corn on the cob with wax worms. Begin.
Have fun. Let's see. Okay. Got some chips.
Oh my god.
That's rancid.
Oh my god.
Just eat it. Eat it and you'll be fine.
Oh boy. Yum. Oh my god. Oh.
Here's a totally new segment we've never done on Paranoid Planet. which is to taste various kinds of exotic foods and emit some judgment on their texture, taste, and deadliness. Now, unlike Joe Rogan, I draw the line way before maggots, flies, and rotten eggs, but that doesn't mean there aren't a lot of other weird things Americans toss in a deep fryer, many of which are, in my view, scarier than any urban legend involving Hillary Clinton. And don't even get me started on what Rhett and Link have been willing to eat and swallow, or retch into a garbage can. So here's a food challenge that the whole family can enjoy, and did, whilst living it up in small-town USA. So I'm standing here just close to the Old Orchard Beach Pier with the Palace Playland on one side and about 300 little pizza kiosks that sell just about anything that's deep fried. So what we're going to try to find out tonight is what is actually worse to eat and better to eat on Old Orchard Beach. So here I am with my my stepsister Julie.
Hi.
Her son Etienne.
Hi.
My son Jean-Daniel.
Hi.
My daughter Eliane.
Hi.
And my charming wife, Shirley, the harbinger of the apocalypse from previous episodes.
Hello.
So what we're going to be doing is we're going to go each on our own side and find some deep-fried tidbit of some sort and try to force it into our bodies and decide to rank them by taste, fillingness, mouthfeel, and the heart attack meter. And then at the end, we'll try to see if there is a winner. And if we have a winner, that essentially means that that's the food most likely to kill you if ever you come to Old Orchard Beach. Are you guys ready?
Yes, we
One,
are.
One, two, three.
Okay, bye.
Hippikaye!
Hippikaye!
How is everything?
Yeah, pretty vile. Are they frozen, the mushrooms?
They should be making them fresh.
Really?
Yes. Okay. Here's the deluxe, and then here's your Monte Crisco.
Thank you. Is that powdered sugar?
Yes.
On the sandwich?
Yes.
With fries?
Yes.
Is that popular?
No.
Jesus. It's actually dripping. Fat.
Ew.
All right, we are back from having shop for all of our things. I could see my daughter got a little hungry. Anyan, what did you purchase?
Ice cream little dots, little ice cream dots.
Ice cream dots, is that the official name for it?
I don't know what the name is.
Is this what astronauts eat in outer space?
No, it's not, because it's melting, so.
Oh, I see. Otherwise,
mini melts.
Mini melts. Okay, it's pretty cold in outer space, so maybe they keep the ice cream outside. Okay, Shirley, you bought some weird-looking things here, full of powder and sticks sticking out of it. What did you find?
We went and got a smorgasbord, so we've got...
which I believe is buffet in
buffet
Swedish.
Buffet of fried food. So yeah. We have deep-fried Oreos, a deep-fried ding-dong, which I'm not quite sure what that is.
I'm not sure what a ding-dong is, but I'm sure we could Google it.
A deep-fried cookie dough and deep-fried Twinkie.
All right, and I found myself some crab cakes, which look like a little bit like hamburger patties that have been overcooked and left on the barbecue far too long. They remind me of SpongeBob SquarePants, and there's a kind of a radioactive orange sauce that goes with it. And I also got a, what is this called? It's called a fried dough blueberry pie with a splotch of whipped cream that has now looked more like something like a jellyfish that died on it. And what did you get, buddy?
I got a crepe with Nutella.
A crepe with Nutella. That's probably the least American thing on the plate right now. Okay, so we're going to... How about we start looking at the... how would you evaluate the visual appeal of each dish? Which of these do you think, Jean-Daniel, looks the best to eat?
A crepe, because it's like one of my favorite foods.
Yeah, because there's Nutella on it, and you're a Nutella monster. what about you, Shirley?
The fried stuff does actually look like it's battered chicken. It could be battered chicken unless you were otherwise aware. To be honest, none of them look over appealing, but...
This is by your high, lofty European standards.
Oh, yes. Very
British.
If
you were sent yourself way, way down low to Vacation City, Maine, which one would you say you'd eat if you were stuck on a desert island?
I would try all of them, to be honest. They don't look terrible, but just knowing that they're deep fried is kind of like, okay, let's do this.
Eliane, what about you?
The crepe is definitely the most appetizing, and the crab cakes definitely the least, because they just look like someone stomped on them. So, and my ice cream is melting, so it doesn't look too great anymore.
But it looked great when you bought it.
It was okay.
Well, I have to agree the crab cakes don't look great, but I did think it sounded like a good idea at the time. When I first got the fried dough, it actually looked really appetizing. Now, maybe not so much. But maybe we'll do is we'll chow down, and then we'll decide to grade each food on other criteria. All right?
Grill it! Deep fry! How you gonna do this? Something wonderful is happening. All across the United States of America, in little towns and big towns and cities, in the plains and the hills, near the beaches, counties, fairs are happening. County fairs, state fairs. Now, the North Carolina State Fair, that's what we are most familiar with. And the thing that we do at the North Carolina State Fair, and I assume this is replicated throughout the country,
it is. We deep fry some stuff.
Every year, I go to the fair wondering, what are they going to deep fry this year that they didn't deep fry last year? I mean, it's been many years since they started deep frying candy bars.
Mm-hmm.
And now,
since
then, they've gotten really creative. I'm talking deep fried chocolate-covered bacon, deep fried donut bacon cheeseburgers, deep fried butter, and deep fried Kool-Aid. How is that even possible? The level of creativity that people are exercising within the context of frying things at state fairs is inspiring. It has inspired us to take it to the next level. We have an assortment of things over here, and we are going to answer the question today on Good Mythical Morning. Will it deep fry? Okay. I'm excited about the things we're going to try. Rhett, you're the prepper, so go ahead and set up item number one here.
Okay, now you've heard of refried beans, but have you heard of deep fried refried beans? Why not fry them again?
Will it deep fry?
Deep fried refried bean balls.
Look at that, though. It's like a mushroom cap, which might not be very healthy, and they have deep fried butter around the country, but what about just straight up fat? Will it deep fry?
No, this is not human fat. Don't get alarmed. This is beef fat. I didn't cut it off myself. I don't know why I would even say that. Okay, here we go. It's still a little rubbery.
Ew.
It's still a little rubbery.
Ew. Deep fried lemons.
Fried wheatgrass. Raw eggs.
Happy Easter, everybody.
Easter special.
Easter came early this year at the fry.
Here, take a bite.
Ooh, that's hot.
Crunchy.
Oh, yeah, the shell's still on it. I totally forgot. Deep fried toothpaste.
Ew, gross. And just like regular toothpaste, you don't actually swallow.
Will it deep fry?
So my sister Julie and her son just showed up. We just graded these in accordance to which looks most and least appetizing. So which one would you most eat if you were given the choice?
I would definitely go for the crepe with Nutella, although it's not deep fried.
And it's not really an American dish.
So I would go for the deep fried cookie dough.
Which was, I think, your sister's favorite.
Yep, yep.
Before she had, like, a major artery clogging.
Yes, indeed, yes.
And which one do you think, even if you were on a desert island, you would not eat?
I would probably eat everything on a desert island, but my least favorite would be the crab cake.
Crab cake, hockey pucks. All right, Etienne, what about you? Favorite food?
This one, the
blueberry pie fried dough.
Yes.
It's the purple color, right?
Yes.
C'est beau, c'est mauve. And what's the one that you don't want to eat?
It's just...
The crab cakes again. Oh, the crab cakes are really getting a beating here. All right, so we're going to taste everything, and then we'll come back with our grades.
Gluttons to your marks. And gorge.
Chew, chew, chew. Chew, chew, chew.
No, Homer, don't fill up on bread.
Huh? Oh, right! What's happening to me? There's still food, but I don't want to eat it.
Right, welcome back to Beach Armchair Food Critic, Old Orchard Beach Edition. The table in front of us looks a little bit like a minefield. World War I, Northern France. There are some little bits of food left over, and you can see what was more popular and what was less. So who wants to start giving us their evaluation? All right, Julie. Which of these would you say on the level of taste you preferred?
Twinkie.
And which one is the worst?
The crab cake.
The crab cake?
Because it was after the Twinkie and after the deep fried blueberry thing, and it was after all the sweets.
Okay,
that
so...
my mistake, sorry.
Always eat fish as an appetizer, right?
Yep.
What about how filling the food is? Which one did you find would fill your belly the fastest?
The Twinkie.
The Twinkie.
It's fluffier.
Okay, and would any of these leave you hungry after eating it?
Not at all.
No, so it's all stodge.
Yep, yep, okay. yep,
Mouthfeel. Which one tasted most like in your mouth? It was like there was a party in your mouth and everyone was invited.
The Twinkie.
I'm seeing a pattern here. And then finally, on the heart attack meter from 1 to 10, which of these would you say would kill you the fastest?
The Ding Dong.
The Ding Dong.
Yep.
All right. Anyone else wants to participate? Eliane, which one did you find the most and the least tasty?
The most tasty was the crepe, and the least tasty was the cookie dough, fried cookie dough.
You weren't too keen on the cookie dough. Why?
It just tastes really bad. It just tasted like you scooped up a bite full of oatmeal and just didn't taste good.
Like really, really sweet goop.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Which one did you find the most filling?
All of them combined.
Which one was most delectable in your mouth?
Crepe.
The crepe? That creamy Nutella flavor?
Yeah.
And then finally, heart attack meter. Which one do you think Dad would die the fastest if he ate every day?
Cookie dough. You wouldn't even eat it every day. It'd last a week.
Probably. Probably would. Great. Shirley, what about you? Which one did you find the most and least tasty?
The most tasty was probably the crepe, probably.
The crepe.
The least, it was actually quite disgusting, it was actually between the crab cake, which I actually spat out, and the Ding Dong.
Now, remember what we told our kids? We don't say disgusting, we say, I didn't like that.
But I didn't like it because it was disgusting.
You're a lousy mom. Okay.
Twinkies were awesome.
Okay, now if you had to put me out of my misery as fast as possible, which one would you be feeding me secretly?
I'd mush them all together and deep fry it all over again.
And then you'd feed that to me on my deathbed.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I have to admit, I liked my blueberry pie, but it didn't seem to have much of a half-life. It kind of got dry and brittle at the bottom. It got all mushy and wet in the middle, so it didn't last very long. I was actually surprised that the crab cake tasted a lot better than it looked like. I agree with Eliane that the cookie dough was just, I don't know, it was just strange, like something oozing. What did you say?
Disappointing.
I think it was worse than that. It was like a pustule that just kind of just oozed out, right, from an open wound.
Kind of.
Yeah. And then finally, I found the Twinkie incredibly disappointing after the Ding Dong. That's right. No, there was something about the Ding Dong that made the Twinkie lose its flair. I don't know.
I'm not leaving any food behind.
Okay, wait. We're going to listen to Julie chomp on some blueberry pie.
Yum, 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 yum.
Okay, well, there you have it. That's what living by the beach will do to you, and the odds are your coronary system. Yum, yum, yum. Now, can you hear her heart clog? You did say you had, like, arrhythmia earlier today, didn't you?
Yeah, I do.
Was that because of some of the fried food?
It's because of the mudslide. I drink it too much and too early in the morning.
Okay.
And the sugar. There's too much sugar in my system right now.
Okay. That's why you only come here for a week, because more than that, you end up in the hospital.
You may die.
I've actually just realized why you often hear an ambulance come down the street. This is why.
Maybe.
Yeah. No, I want to keep the crab cakes. Thanks. I'm sitting here in, I think it's Scarborough, Maine.
Yes, you are at Scarborough, Maine.
And it's a beautiful little a marsh, the river zigzagging through high grass, and I'm speaking to...
Linda Woodard.
And Linda, what do you do here?
I'm the director of the Scarborough Marsh Audubon Center.
And how long have you been doing this?
32 years.
Wow. And what can people expect to do if they come to visit your, what do you call this here, your nature center?
Well, we have a 3,100-acre marsh. It's actually the largest salt marsh in Maine. So we have a lot of ways to see it. You can go by canoe or kayak. We have walking trails that go through it. There's a lot to see. You know, some people just want to recreate and be in a boat. Some people want to see the birds. Some people want to see some of the insects. So there's a lot to see.
And are you originally from this area?
I've been here for over 50 years.
50 years. So never lived in the city, big city?
I lived in Springfield, Mass., so that was a little bigger.
Is that the same Springfield that Homer Simpson lives in?
I don't know. I don't think so.
I think they picked that name because there are so many Springfields in the U.S. that you wouldn't know which state they're from. That's right. Okay, and what's the kind of the weirdest or strangest or scariest thing that's ever happened here?
Oh, actually, it just happened. That was sort of weird. We had someone go into a side channel, which we tell people not to do. And so they went up in there anyway, and they got stuck. And they were sitting there for 4 hours because the tide had gone out on them. So we couldn't get her out, and it was getting towards dark. So we had called the police, and then they called the ward service, and they had to get an airboat and come out and try to rescue them. So that was quite an exciting time.
Did they have to chew their legs off to get out of the muck?
Practically. There was a woman that and her son, and they had to like have a warden on each side of her and like walk her out to the airboat.
Are there any dangerous animals here? Are there alligators or anything like that?
No, just the marsh monster. No, we don't really have anything dangerous here. So
Ogopogos?
Just people. That's
well, that brings me to my next question. Now, you see a lot of tourists here. Let's be frank, just between you and me, no one will ever hear us. What do you really think about those French-Canadian tourists?
Oh, the French-Canadians are great, actually. Some other tourists, maybe not. But yeah, no, we have, it's a great time. I actually have a friend, Helene, who I've met because she's been here every year I've been here, and we've become great friends, and she's from Quebec. And she actually has translated all of our trail maps and everything into French. So, and sometimes when I get in trouble, I actually will call her up and say, here, talk to these people. I don't know what's wrong.
Well, you can't understand a word. Even if you did speak French, sometimes you wouldn't understand what they said. My wife's from Northern Ireland. She studied French for about 5 years before coming to Canada. And her first family dinner at my place, she says, I've studied this in university. I can't understand a word anybody says.
It is a little different French.
It is. Our show is about conspiracy theories and scary things and paranoia. So have you ever seen anything weird, illegal going on here that maybe the authorities should look into?
Sheesh, no, not really. It's more people breaking rules as far as canoeing and getting stuck and doing all kinds of things like that. But I can't really think of anything like that.
No tattooed Mexican drug lords bringing people wrapped in carpets?
So. We've had some, sort of sketchy people here, but... No, I can't say that we had. We did have a group from the UN come, and we had to have the Secret Service come in their boats, and they had to check us all out. So, yes, they came because they were sort of nervous. I guess we looked a little shady, but they checked us all out, and they brought the UN ambassadors and everything here. But
are there any UFO sightings in this area?
Oh, we do see some strange things right here in the marsh. You never know what you're going to see.
Maybe it's John over there setting up some lights in the sky with some fireworks.
It could be. Yeah. It could be.
He looked like he was up to no good. I'd have his record checked out.
Definitely.
Okay. Thanks, Linda. It was great talking to you.
Good talking to you.
We left Maine this morning, none the wiser about whether people from Maine are more paranoid than people from Texas or anywhere else. And we've been driving a while over the New Hampshire White Mountain National Forest, which is a very nice and rural, foresty, mountainous area, as the name implies. You can understand why in 1961, in the darkness of night in this area, along Route 3, just north of Lincoln, New Hampshire, which is where we are right now, a couple called Betty and Barney Hill stopped their car, looked at some lights in the sky, and later on believed that they saw a UFO. Now, accounts are very different of what different people think the Hills actually saw. But there is a sign here right by the highway that says the Betty and Barney Hill incident. On the night of September 19 to 20, 1961, Portsmouth, New Hampshire couple Betty and Barney Hill experienced a close encounter with an unidentified flying object and 2 hours of lost time while driving south on Route 3 near Lincoln. they filed an official Air Force Project Blue Book report of a brightly lit cigar-shaped craft the next day, but were not public with their story until it was leaked in the Boston Traveler in 1965. This was the first widely reported UFO abduction report in the United States. End quote. Now, I would like to do an entire episode on this at some point because it is, in many ways, the first, not necessarily UFO travel narrative, but it is the first claim that someone was taken away against their will by aliens who eventually came to be the traditional grays of the blue, the big eyes, you know, the little slit of a mouth, who experiment on unwitting Americans or, well, people in general. But you hear a lot of these stories in the United States. Now, there's a whole lot of backstory. There's a whole bunch of information that is sometimes left out or added to the story, which makes it incredibly simplistic in most of these their accounts. So needless to say, I'm not going to spend any time here explaining what my view is or what I think happened, but there's certainly a number of skeptical and credulous and in-between opinions about what happened to Betty and Barney Hill. But this may just be the one indicator that shows that, yes, there is indeed a good deal of paranoia in New Hampshire, or at least from this event, because it's gone on to become, after maybe the Kennedy assassination, one of the most conspiratorial and, I would say, para-religious events of the 20th century that have created an entire movement of people who believe that extraterrestrials are visiting our planet, that they are abducting individuals, maybe even going so far as to say that they are creating alien-human hybrids, and who knows what. There's not much to see here except for the plaque, but there's a great deal of information on the internet. There are some interesting podcasts available, and as I said, I do hope to spend some time on this, picking it apart. Maybe after the Kennedy assassination, it might just be one of the most complex conspiracy events to analyze with various experts and believers.
Not to carry it too far, but they were kind of the, you know, the Adam and Eve of alien abduction.
A quiet, unassuming New Hampshire couple with a story that would shape what's out of this world.
Do you think that E.T. would look the way that E.T. looks without Betty and Barney Hill?
No.
Bill Ross, a professor emeritus at UNH, is responsible for curating the school's extensive collection on the Betty and Barney Hill abduction.
Betty and Barney Hill's collection gets 17% of our web traffic.
As the story goes, on September 19th, 1961, Betty and Barney Hill were driving home from their honeymoon in Montreal. As they drove through New Hampshire's White Mountains, they said they were followed by what felt like a spotlight. Eventually, they pulled over and said they spotted a ship floating above their car.
They were kind of enveloped by this light from the ship that they had seen and then kind of blacked out.
When they came to, they said they were in their car, miles down the road, and couldn't remember the last 2 hours.
There were mysterious marks on their car. The zipper on Betty's dress was torn and it was stained. The strap on Barney's binoculars were broken.
For the most part, they kept their story quiet. But after experiencing nightmares and anxiety, the couple turned to hypnosis to see whether there were suppressed memories of the event. It appears there were. Eventually, a Boston reporter picked up their story, and readers went crazy to learn more.
They went public, basically to try to own their story, because, you know, they were kind of thrust into the limelight without their permission.
That story, believe it or not, has had a lasting impact.
My fascination is just with the impact that their story had.
And Bill Ross says he himself is a skeptic, but there are, of course, a lot of believers out there. You can learn much more about this story yourself by visiting the Special Collections Library at the University of New Hampshire.
Chapter 3. Take me to your leader, No, make that your gullible masses. On my way back to Canada through the White Mountains of New Hampshire, I searched for some podcasts on the subject of Betty and Barney Hill's alleged UFO abduction. And I came across a show called Strange Arrivals, written and hosted by journalist and author Toby Ball. Strange Arrivals, which will soon begin streaming its third season, offers a very professional and level-headed analysis of the Betty and Barney Hill affair and of other alleged UFO phenomena. So I decided to reach out to a fellow podcaster and ask him about his podcasting experience, his interest in UFOs, and other related subjects. Here's our conversation, which was recorded in August 2022.
We're going to a deep, deep sleep. Your eyes are getting heavy. We're going back to September
19, 1961. I'm Betty Hill, and my husband Barney and I were the first to be abducted by astronauts from another solar system.
Today I'm speaking with Toby Ball, a New Hampshire-based journalist and podcaster, who is not to be confused with Toby Hall, the former Tampa Bay Devil Rays baseball player, whom I accidentally contacted by mistake to seek information about UFO abductions. So my apologies to Mr. Hall, who I'm sure now thinks I'm some sort of crackpot. Toby Ball, however, does have a special interest in UFO culture and beliefs. I reached out to him after my drive through the White Mountain Range of New Hampshire, looking for the spot where Betty and Barney Hill allegedly saw, maybe even were abducted, by an extraterrestrial spaceship during the summer of 1961. Toby, welcome to Paranoid Planet.
Thanks for having me on.
So while I was doing this drive, I was looking for some information on Betty Hill. I had read a few things before, but I was looking for a podcast to listen to while I was driving, because it's hard to read a book while you're driving. And so I looked for podcasts about Betty Hill, and a lot of them were bunk, or I didn't trust them. But then I remember this show that I used to listen to called Stuff They Don't Want You to Hear, or Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. That's what it was.
Yep.
And you were on there. I hadn't heard of you, but I listened to it, and I thought this was really informative. So I thought it would be a great way to cap these episodes by having you on the show. So maybe we can start by you telling us a little bit about yourself, maybe your origins, your professional life, and whether or not your wife thinks you're a crackpot.
So, as of about 2.5 months ago, I'm a full-time podcaster. Prior to that, I worked at a couple of universities in Northern New England. I've done some climate activism, taught high school for a year. And I worked at Congressional Quarterly magazine back in the 90s. So I haven't had a very straight trajectory, but I've done a bunch of interesting things. And I got into podcasting about 8 years ago as a member of it's sort of a panel review podcast that comes out every couple weeks. A couple times a week. And then from there, I started sort of branching out and making my own scripted podcast, which is called Strange Arrivals, which deals with sort of a skeptical look at UFOs, but trying to deal with sort of issues that UFOs bring up that you can take a look at scientifically or through sociology or what have you. That seems to be sort of the most interesting part of the UFO stuff, rather than is it real? Is it not real? Is this a hoax? Is it not a hoax? There's plenty of podcasts that do that kind of thing, and I'm trying to look at other issues rather than make some definitive case pro for or against, although I am a skeptic and tend to think there are alternative explanations.
Okay, so you explore the sociology, the culture, maybe even the religiosity of UFO belief.
I've been looking at, in the first couple seasons, there's some looking at religiosity. For the third season, I'm spending a little bit more time there. So I just and science, looking at memory and how hypnosis works and things like that. But I think there's, particularly around the development of sort of what we think about as being sort of you know, the UFO folklore, what we think we know about UFOs, like how did that develop? How do stories morph and change over time?
Were you interested in UFOs growing up, or is it something that came later?
Yeah, I was definitely interested in them growing up, you know, in my, you know, from age 8 to 14 or something,
so
like that.
If you're,
you know,
my age, Close Encounters of the Third Kind probably freak you out.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah, that, like In Search Of, there was, you know, in the 70s, you know, UFOs, Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, that was all like kind of big stuff. Like, you could go to the theater and see, you know, major release movies about it, about those phenomenon. So, yeah, I was into it. And then, you know, up until about 5 years ago, it was something that I was somewhat interested in. You know, I didn't like keep very close tabs on what was happening, but, you know, sometimes like back in the Blockbuster days, you know, we would rent like old, you know, compilations of In Search Of to like hang out and like have a few beers. And
I did that with X-Files in college. That was kind of our go-to thing. I'd have a few friends, oddly enough, from church. And after the church service, we'd go to someone's house and we'd be watching X-Files. So it's like having two different religious experiences in the same day.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So in the first episode, and you also talked about this in the interview I mentioned, Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, you had this encounter with lights in the sky one day with your friend and I think your two wives. Can you briefly explain to us how this created an interest in looking into the Barney and Betty Hill story?
Sure. So, you know, sort of briefly, it was, you know, late dusk one night, and we were up on an island in New Hampshire looking across the water. And like off in the distance is, you know, not sure how far it was. It was a little bit hard to get any kind of sense of whether it was over these hills or between us and the hills. But we saw, you know, three or four red lights sort of hovering, moving around a little bit. Then there were more lights, you know, it probably got up to seven or eight, and sort of moved around. Didn't like leave a certain area, but depending on sort of how you're conceiving it, it was either changing shape or they were changing in their sort of attitude to each other in the air. And then they, depending on who you talk to and what their memory is, either kind of blinked out one by one or took off, you know, until they were out of sight. So there's a couple things that were interesting. One was, like right off the bat, of the four people who saw this, two were instantly like, those are UFOs. Those must be alien spacecraft. And then the other two, including myself, were like, I don't know exactly what that was, but I'm pretty sure it's not aliens. I think there's probably something pretty, you know, pretty normal, but I don't happen to know what it is.
Was
then
there
later,
an airport or a military base nearby?
There's a small airport. I mean, they definitely weren't I mean, we see airplanes all the time. Right. There's, you know, it's, the lake isn't exactly remote, but, you know, on a clear night, there's a zillion stars. So we spend a fair amount of the time outside at night, having a drink, looking at the stars. So we've seen airplanes and satellites. Okay. And, you know,
and it was late at night, though, or was it at dusk?
No, it was like late dusk. Right. Okay.
So
it's,
so these were not
the sunset
flares.
Had just faded.
This was not helicopters.
No,
balloons, air, you know, weather balloons, you know, like the classic explanations.
No, I don't think so. I mean, there's a whole bunch of them, you know, and it wasn't like the Phoenix lights, I guess, where it seemed like they were all sort of stayed in the same relationship to each other, and descended. Yeah, I mean, I don't know to this day what it would have been, but that, you know, that doesn't mean it's not explainable easily. It just means that that's not sort of my vocabulary or my knowledge of to be able to identify that.
So there's an X-Files episode waiting there.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, because of that, and it was something else, it was something, you know, given the time when I started working on the first season of Strange Arrivals, it just got me sort of interested in the question of like, why do some people, you know, believe in things that we don't have the kind of evidence that we would normally sort of demand of belief, like the kind of evidence that you would like look for if you're finding somebody guilty in a courtroom or what have you, versus people who are naturally skeptical. And you know, what was that difference? And it could be applied to a bunch of different things at the time. You know, there's political stuff where, you know, depending on which side of the aisle you were on, you definitely believed or you definitely did not believe. And that was another thing. It's like, why are the standards of evidence different? So that was sort of the idea. And I was trying to think of how to make a podcast that people would be interested in listening to. You know, you need some kind of hook. It's not just me, like sort of, you know, stream of consciousness talking about those issues. And I live in the town in New Hampshire where the University of New Hampshire is, and that's where the Betty and Barney Hill archives are.
Where is that? So, is that Portsmouth?
No, it's Durham, okay. Durham, New Hampshire. You know, 6 miles from Portsmouth.
Okay. So it's near where they lived and the story sort of began.
Yeah. And they drove by my house hadn't been built yet, but they drove on Route 4, which I can see from my house. On their way back that night. And we, you know, we had a mutual friend who I interviewed for the podcast. And yeah, I mean, they're very much a part of sort of local history, in no small part because of their work on civil rights stuff back in the
60s. Okay. That's interesting. It'd be like me, because I had some interest in doing stuff on MK Ultra because there's a whole story here in Montreal at the Allen Memorial Clinic where there were some doctors, particularly a man called Ewan Cameron, who was receiving funding from the CIA. And I don't know if he knew or didn't know where it was coming from, but in order to do like mind control programs. But anyway, so there's kind of a personal interest in the local, which at the same time is a story that has generated so many other narratives and influenced them that that's kind of, it was logical for you to go there.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, you know, I knew the basic outline of the story, right? Like a lot of people, it's one of the most famous UFO stories that's out there. But it was, you know, like I guess as with most things, when you start looking at it, you start to pick up on the nuances. And I sort of expanded the scope a little bit, partly because, you know, I'd started it off as just something I was doing myself. And then once I signed on with iHeart, you know, the number of episodes expanded and I had to look for other things to talk about. And one of those things was, you know, how did the abduction story, not just their abduction story, but just the cultural blueprint for what a UFO abduction looks like, how did that change over time? And it just, you know, it sticks. That's the building block of an abduction with, you know, missing time and medical experiments and an interest in reproduction and things like that. And over time, the story expanded, but maintained that core to it. So even when you get to like the really late people interested in alien abductions, like, you know, Bud Hopkins and John Mack and David Jacobs, it still is similar stuff. It's, you know, being abducted, not remembering it, missing time, interest in reproduction, and so on. And even the way that the aliens look, you know, the gray alien kind of starts with Betty and Barney Hill.
So for people who are believers, the Betty and Barney Hill story becomes something they can mine in order to find justification for their own story. They could say, well, I'm not making this up because something like this happened to Betty and Barney, at least the parts that are similar. And for a skeptic, then it's kind of it sets the blueprint for what other people might fabulate or invent or hoax later on.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's, you know, I was even talking to a pretty prominent sort of UFO proponent, and I was asking him about, you know, what did he think were the most convincing cases in his mind, and he brought up Betty and Barney Hill as being one of the most convincing cases. So it's had that kind of staying power. But yeah, I think as a skeptic, you know, and if you just look at it as, like, I don't think anybody thinks they were, like, trying to pull one over or being dishonest. I think people think they genuinely believed it happened. But what they did is create, you know, this story template that then people who maybe were less sincere or were very sincere and just heard this template, and that kind of affected the way they interpreted, you know, whatever the impetus was for them to come up with this story. And I that's one of the interesting things about them, right, is that there are these two, this couple who, you know, were remarkable in other ways, but they weren't, you know, it wasn't like L. Ron Hubbard or something where they were science fiction writers or whatever, but they sort of co-created this story that had such resonance that, you know, we're talking about it today, like more than 60 years later.
For those people who are not familiar with it, can you summarize just the general elements of the Betty and Barney Hill story, at least the way that it's popularly told now through TV and movies?
Sure. So, this is the end of a vacation trip that they made, and they were going to, we were planning on spending the night in Montreal, and there's a whole bunch of sort of, you know, theorized reasons why they didn't spend the night in Montreal, but they end up leaving.
Who wouldn't want to spend the night in Montreal?
I love Montreal, actually. We go up there
all the
time. There's
smoked meat, there's alcohol, there's plenty of dancing. There's lots to do here. And if you're 18, you know, it's like heaven on earth until the next morning.
That's right. Well, then a lesson's been learned. So they leave Montreal fairly late at night. They stop. They cross over into the U.S. They stop at a diner. They note the time as they're leaving. And then based on that time, they have an expectation of returning home to their house in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, I think at about 2 a.m. They drive south, and as they're getting closer and closer to the White Mountains, they see a light in the sky. And this is, you know, this is in early 60s. This is a place that's remote now.
Did they mention the color of the light? Was it a white light or a red light?
I think it was just, I think it was white.
So like a really bright star or something.
Really bright star. And this is when the, you know, there's very little light pollution. So, I mean, you've got the full array out there.
It's still dark as hell when you drive through New Hampshire. I remember a couple times going in the dark and thinking, without the high beams, you could hit a deer or a tree before you even knew it was there.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's several like sort of segments in this encounter. And the first one is this light that they think it's following them. They pull over, they take a look through binoculars, I believe. But there's no sound, can't quite figure it out. And they proceed into Franconia Notch. So there's three notches you can go through the White Mountains that have roads that go through them. And Franconia Notch, when you go through it, it's got these very steep mountains on either side. I mean, you're really just kind of going through this little sort of narrow passage. So it feels a little claustrophobic. You certainly can't see much to either side of you at night. It's just these sort of imposing mountains. But as they go in, they think they see an actual craft right by this old, it has since collapsed. There used to be this tourist area called the Old Man of the Mountain, which was a sort of rock face that looked at a certain angle, looked like an old man. So they see the craft next to the old man, and they make some calculations about how big it is. They get back in their car, you know, they're stressed, and they're very tired. It's late at night at this point. and they're driving down the road. They feel like it's over on top, it's on top of their car. I mean, not on, but hovering above their car. And they pull over into a field where the UFO is. And Barney gets out, he gets out his binoculars, and he looks through them, and he sees people looking back at him.
So this is the second time they stop and he looks through the binoculars, is it?
Yeah. So this is when they're closer. So this is in a field. So they're close.
Okay. Did they call it a flying saucer, or because there was the memorial there near Lincoln says a cigar shaped object, or did they mention the shape of the spaceship?
So I believe so. I don't know if it was you or somebody else who pointed out the cigar shape thing. And I don't know if that was taken from a picture. Certainly my impression, and part of this was talking to Betty's niece, Kathleen Martin. So, you know, I don't know how much that kind of pollutes the story a little bit. My sense was that it was a disc that was spinning. Like that, like I think they say they saw lights that rotated around.
Okay. Because some people have said maybe they saw a gondola. And I'll say it on the record before somebody steals my theory, that it sounds a lot like the bottom part of a blimp where you can't see the blimp, you know, just the row of windows in the gondola underneath what they called an airship back then.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't know if anybody specifically looked to see if there was like that kind of craft cruising around in the White Mountains. I mean, there's an Air Force base that is kind of near there, and there's, you know, been a lot of talk about their radar.
Season 3 of your podcast right there. I've got it for you.
Yeah. the blimp episode.
The invisible airship. The stealth airship.
So they're in this you know, they're in this field. He looks through the binoculars. He sees people looking back out at him. He sort of thinks one looks like a Nazi, another looks like a friendly Irishman.
was he holding a pint of Guinness?
Yeah, he doesn't specify. But so, I mean, what's kind of interesting about that to me is that Barney was a postal worker who worked in Boston, and you know, at that time, I think he would have thought, just based on Boston's sort of racial history, that seeing an Irish person would generally be something that he would be very wary of. So I think it was like this weird contradiction of somebody who I would normally, you know, would get my adrenaline going a little bit. But in this case, he seems like he's friendly.
That threw me off because I'm thinking of like Bill Burr or Conan O'Brien, you know, sitting up on an aircraft waving down to Barney Hill.
No, I think it's more like Donnie Wahlberg or somebody, like, you know. Anyway, at that point, he jumps back in the car. He's in kind of a panic. He felt as though he was sort of being communicated with sort of mentally, and it scares him. They jump in the car. They hear a couple of buzzing sounds or kind of feel it. And they feel a couple more, and they've realized they're about 30 miles down the road. And at that point, they, you know, they're still highly stressed. They try and find a police officer in Concord, which is the state capital, unsuccessful in that. They drive home. They're expecting to get home around 2. They get home around 5 in the morning. So they wonder what happened with that missing time.
Do you know this book? I think you talked to Terry Matheson. I'm holding it up.
Oh, yeah.
But we're only an audio podcast. So this is called Alien Abductions by Professor Terry Matheson from the University of Saskatchewan. I think you interviewed him on your show.
Yep.
And he says something about the fact that the Hills didn't really make much of a big deal about missing time until the ufologists thought that it was. And that got later into... engaged in their story. Anyways, I'm bringing a parenthesis here, but I thought it was interesting that this whole idea of missing time is touted by many as the main piece of evidence, and yet it didn't seem to be the big piece of evidence at the beginning for them.
Right. I mean, their big piece of evidence. I mean, they get back and they, you know, they draw pictures of basically the same thing that they saw. you know, Betty seems to be sort of the driver of getting the word out, but you know, they both were eventually appeared on radio shows together. You know, they're both sort of eloquent talkers. So they get in touch with Pease Air Force Base, which is, you know, right next to Portsmouth. NICAP, which was a civilian UFO investigation group, sends an investigator to talk to them. And Betty has these dreams, these very vivid dreams that involve being abducted by aliens, and she writes them down. It eventually becomes titled Dreams or Recall. And then about 2 years later, Barney, who had struggled with psychological issues,
anxiety, I think, was the diagnosis.
Yeah, he had anxiety. I mean, I think there's a bunch of things going on in his life. So he ends up being recommended to go to see a therapist who uses hypnosis, and he used it very successfully with returning members of the military for what we would call PTSD now.
This is not a ufologist. This is not like Bud Hopkins, who is looking for a UFO abduction story.
No. And this guy's like, you know, I think, you know, again, it's like the early 60s, and we didn't know as much about hypnosis at the time, but this guy's very, very respected in his field.
Benjamin Simon, was that his name?
Benjamin Simon, yep. So they go down and see him, and it's during this point where they uncover this idea that there's, you know, two missing hours, say, and that he and Betty sort of hypnotize separately, tell sort of mutually reinforcing, though not exactly the same, stories about after that first buzzing when they left the field, sort of taking this random turn off the highway, being stopped by figures in the road who then pull them from their car, take them to a spaceship, subject them to sort of a physical exam. Barney basically just closes his eyes and prays most of the time. Betty ends up having sort of a conversation with this one who can communicate with her, is shown a map that shows where they come from, which becomes sort of a bigger deal later.
So she has a very pleasant experience talking to some British-speaking alien, while Barney has his very kind of negative experience, a fearful, almost like a concentration camp testing sort of experience.
Yeah, he does. And then he also, like his one, he says he had his eyes closed most of the time. He does open his eyes one time, and what he sees is sort of this terrifying alien creature kind of hovering over him as part of the exam, I guess. Betty's sort of visualization of them is a sort of a lot more humanoid, less threatening, more sort of, you know, people who are working on board a ship, right? You know, you've got the worker people, and you've
it's
got
like she went
the
to the dentist and he went to the Nazis.
yeah, exactly. So this is kind of what gets uncovered through these hypnosis sessions. You know, Dr. Simon, what he believes is that they're basically recalling Betty's dreams that she talked about a lot, and she's recalling her dreams, and Barney's sort of doing the mental work to see where he fit into those dreams, like what his experience could have been. And the dreams themselves are, as in that she recorded in that document called Dreams or Recall, it's basically exactly the same as what she recalls under hypnosis, right? So,
okay. So her dreams are essentially fueling, at least whether they're real or not, they're fueling what she saw under hypnosis.
Right. I mean, it's just there's very, very, very minor differences, but the crux and even most of the details are exactly the same as her dreams. So, you know, that's essentially, that's the story in a nutshell.
And then Dr. Simon basically concludes that they're having some sort of psychosis, or they're mutually reinforcing, like a mutual hallucination of some sort?
Yeah, I mean, what he says is he believes something happened that night, but that the abduction thing is really just Betty's dreams. I mean, I think what he would say is, you know, hypnosis is not you like playing back some videotape of what happened 2 years ago. It's, you know, there's all these other things that are mixed up with it. Whereas her version is sort of rich with details and conversations and stuff. His version is really, I had my eyes closed and I perceived that they were doing these things to me, but I don't know, have a whole lot of details. I was hoping it would go away. There's a vast difference in how precise the stories are, which I think also kind of talks to the point of one person's describing these intense dreams they had, the other person's trying to visualize like what would their part have been if that had actually been true.
Yeah, well, Terry Matheson says that Barney Hill, who died quite early on, right, in his 40s of stroke or something.
Yeah.
So he didn't have time to go on and develop the story at length, but he suggests that Barney Hill never fully believed that these were real memories. Whereas last night, I watched this old NBC movie called The UFO Incident. You're probably aware of, was about their story. It was an NBC show in, I think, 1975. And in that one, it's really driven by Barney, right? Which is kind of interesting because Barney's played by Darth Vader, or what's his name? James Earl Jones.
Yeah.
And so it was interesting how the story seems to evolve from Barney being a reluctant participant to becoming the person who is most ready to believe that he was abducted by aliens. And yet somehow, even though he had this kind of Nazi experience in outer space, the film concludes that he and Betty kind of lived happily, content with the fact that their memories were indeed real. We don't need to debunk or go into too much depth here. Maybe we can do that at a later date. But could you identify maybe like the two or three things that skeptics are most likely to point out as being problems with the veracity of the story?
There's a few different things that people point to. And the first is that what they originally saw was probably Jupiter. And that, you know, when you're driving on these winding country roads and you're sort of in the trees and then out of the trees, it's very easy for it to look like, you know, Jupiter is changing positions in the sky, like it's a craft that's moving, when in fact it's you that's moving. And then, as you would imagine, like the more detailed sighting they have, the sort of more difficult it is to explain away. But there is, you know, there's a tramway that runs up right next to the old man, the mountain, and a tram car would roughly match the pictures that they drew. They weren't sort of officially running at that time of night, but there's a restaurant up there. So there's some question about whether they would be running back and forth, people or supplies or whatever. The one that's really difficult to explain for most people is the sighting in the field. But a guy, Jim McDonald, has a set of theories and that there was a jack-o'-lantern motel with a giant inflatable jack-o'-lantern that I believe might have been internally lit too.
Yeah, I was looking for that, but I don't think it exists anymore, does it?
No, I don't think so. Okay. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I the only thing I could get of it was a postcard.
But that was orange, right? It was like a big orange. That's why I asked you about the color of the light earlier, because I don't remember I didn't read anything about the hill saying that this thing was changing color from white to orange or whatnot. So maybe sometimes we're also seeing explanations that make sense to us, but they don't fit with what these people recall or described.
Right. And I think, you know, even for those kinds of descriptions, the factors of fatigue and panic do a lot of work in saying something that they should have been able to recognize pretty easily, they saw and panicked and misinterpreted, right? So that's like a big part. I even talked to Robert Schaefer, who's, you know, probably the leading skeptic to do research on this. And he's just like, I don't even know what they saw at that point, but they were so discombobulated, you know, so sort of quote unquote out of their mind. That,
well, they were sleep deprived, right? I think that's one thing that's important to point out is I think they drove from Niagara Falls to Toronto to Montreal and then to New Hampshire. Was that all in one day?
No, I think they stayed outside Toronto, but okay. Then they drove from Toronto to Montreal, drove around Montreal for a while, and then headed down.
Yeah, well, that's a lot of driving.
Yes.
And they didn't have interstate, so what we have today. I mean, I drove from Washington, D.C. to Nashville a few weeks ago, and that was an 11-hour drive, and I was exhausted by the end.
Yeah.
And it was the day. I mean, if it had been at night, I probably would have hit the side of the road at some point.
Yeah, and then you're in this, you know, unfamiliar territory. You know, it's extremely, extremely dark. I think there was an added factor that there was, you know, Barney was anxious. I mean, they were an interracial couple, which I probably should have brought up earlier. And Barney was concerned about what the reception would be for them, both in Canada and rural New Hampshire. So I think there was also that was working on them, is this sort of tension based around that.
Yeah, Matheson tries to, he concludes that there was some kind of a racist, maybe even a sexual experience on the road where some people tried to stop them, set up a roadblock or something. Now, I don't know if there's any evidence to that. It may just be that Matheson finds it easier to believe that a lot of these types of memories are foils for some kind of sexual abuse that people have, you know, which is shameful and people don't want to remember. But it's interesting how their story in some ways resembles these other non-UFO stories about abuse, about racism, about fears of medicine or things like that, experimentation. And the UFOs sometimes and sometimes not seem to be coming in and out of the story. As you said, you know, an Irishman in some kind of craft with windows wearing a military uniform. That's why I thought that sounds like an airship that's kind of running tests in some dark valley, or maybe just, you know, is doing some kind of reconnaissance exercise, and he just happened to stumble on it in the middle of the night, and then all of that got mixed in with his other anxieties.
Yeah, you know, I talk a little bit on the podcast in that I think, you know, regardless of what he saw, I think he was kind of projecting a little bit. He'd been in World War II, and then he was working in Boston, and sort of the Nazi and, you know, an Irish person from Boston would be people he would see as people he was in conflict with, right? So that he was sort of projecting his anxieties upon whatever he was seeing, fearing that they were going to do something bad to him. On the other hand, Betty... You know, especially in her sort of abduction story, is almost sort of the opposite, right? Where she kind of sees them as being, you know, opportunity to have friends and, you know, be kind of let in on secrets and sort of, you know, builds up her sense of importance rather than feeling like threatened.
Have you heard of Jean Hill? Jean Hill is not related to Betty Hill. She was one of the closest people to the limousine during the Kennedy assassination. The so-called woman in the red coat, Oliver Stone makes a big deal of her in his movie JFK. She was one of the closest ones, and yet she got so many things wrong about what happened on that thing. Now, apart from the fact that they both have the same last name, they're both kind of middle-aged women who have a tendency to remember things that clearly didn't happen or no other witnesses saw. So there's got to be some kind of explanation. I'm not saying that they were mentally ill, but both of them had the tendency to fabulate, to use that to kind of make conversation with other people, to have these fantastic stories about their lives. I mean, Jean Hill went on to explain that she was having an affair with one of the motorcycle policemen who was following Kennedy's limousine, and then would later say things that were clearly disproven with photographic evidence, that she touched the limousine when it was driving past. If she had, she would have been run over by two motorcycles. And no pictures show her in the street. She's always about 15, 20 feet away from the limousine. So it's interesting how these two women, in completely different contexts are in a position where you think that they are a great eyewitness and they're very sociable, they're very outspoken. Betty Hill was a social worker, Jean Hill was an elementary school teacher, and yet they come out with a story that confounds people. Skeptics will dismiss them as crackpots, or at least fabulists, and believers, though, will latch onto them as, you know, the ultimate truthsayer. So it's interesting how these two women, who probably never met and were not related, have such a similar type of experience in front of an event that they couldn't explain, that they ended up creating a whole myth around themselves about what it meant.
Yeah, and I look at it a little bit, this kind of thing in the first season, which is both the Hills in this particular situation, you know, the academic I interviewed about this talks about one of the things that comes up again and again is that you do place yourself as a hero or the protagonist of the story that you're living in. So it's not surprising that if you are at the Kennedy assassination, over time, you might inflate your, you know, proximity to it, mm-hmm. or your, you know,
or your significance for being there. Yeah.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, that kind of shows up later with Betty, is that she absolutely sort of embraces this idea that she is a conduit from space aliens to Earth.
Because I've seen this a lot with the Kennedy assassination. People who end up seeing a small portion of an event that has nothing to do with them, but they somehow develop that into a much wider narrative, claiming that they saw Jack Ruby, or they saw Lee Harvey Oswald at their place of work, or that they saw them on Adili Plaza a few hours or a few days before the whole event happened. When people know these people were not there. They're shown to have been somewhere else. So there's a tendency to only see one little piece of history and then to somehow try to fill all the unknown with things that they assume might be true, maybe actual events they had, or as we've mentioned, dreams and conversations, secondhand information they received from other people or from TV. And then somehow we remember a story that we only experienced maybe 20 seconds of that hour-long story we have in our mind. That's why I thought the airship thing might be interesting, because you hear strange noises, you see a light in the sky, you get out of your car to go check, and you stumble upon something you never expected to see in the dark. You're flabbergasted, you run away fearful, and then later on your wife has these nightmares that might end up making this make sense, right? Suddenly it makes sense that the ship was there at that time because they were looking for you, not that you just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a bunch. There's several different things that are going on, and the other thing is that when you tell a story, what you're remembering isn't the original event. It's you're remembering the last time you told the story, so it gets polluted over time, and especially something like, you know, the Kennedy assassination or being abducted by UFOs. That's something you're going to be talking about constantly. Or thinking about constantly. So I think the opportunity for the memory to get polluted is, you know, it's just right there. You know, it makes it's scary when you think about the number of people who are in prison because of eyewitness testimony and stuff. And it's just not super reliable.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed that too. Now, and maybe I can just cap our talk about the Hills in saying that there was a book in the 60s by John Fuller called The Interrupted Journey, right? And that's kind of much more than the film I mentioned, the UFO incident. That's kind of what gelled the story, much as what has evolved into the modern abduction narrative, right?
Right. Yeah. So Fuller wrote a two-part article for Look magazine that then got turned into this book. He had access to the hypnosis files. So there's like a hell of a lot of just like transcript stuff in the book, but yeah,
Barney screaming about bears and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean it's alarming when you actually hear the audio of the hypnosis sessions. Like they're intense, right? I mean these are what they're experiencing under hypnosis has an emotional effect on them. That doesn't mean it's more true, but it does mean that it felt true to them. So yeah, I mean, that was the thing that sort of got it into the public's eye. And then, you know, they're on, you know, TV shows and radio shows, and Barney was on To Tell the Truth, and Betty was on a game show like thing called Lie Detector with F. Lee Bailey, where she gets hooked up, I think, to a lie detector. So they became sort of like minor celebrities, and like major celebrities on the UFO circuit.
So let me make a segue and move away from this. And like I said, I would love to have you back on the show later on, and we could delve deeper into this and Rendlesham Forest and some of the other issues you talk about in your podcast. Just as a reminder, the podcast is called Strange Arrivals. It's available everywhere, I guess. Apple.
Yep.
iHeartRadio. And is it on Spotify?
Yeah, it's on Spotify, okay. Pocket Cast.
All right.
You know,
so almost everywhere you find Paranoid Planet, you'll find Strange Arrivals. In the process of doing this podcast, have you become more or less of a skeptic about UFO encounters?
I think I'm more of a skeptic. I think the more you look into things, you either find that there are, you know, pretty easy, plausible alternatives to a UFO, and then some of the other stuff is just like pretty thin gruel, as they say, or like the promise of things to come, or things without much evidence, where you're really relying upon like a preponderance of similar stories, and there's like real problems with that being used as evidence. Like 300 people told the same story. It's like, well, you know, are there reasons for that other than they all experience the same thing? And I think in most cases there is. So, and that I asked this exact same question of Chris Carter, who's a creator of the X-Files. And I was like, man, you must have gotten just a barrage of like people writing you about their UFO encounters. Like how did that affect things? And he said the same. He was just like, the more I learned, the less I believed. I got all this stuff and nothing like held up to like tight scrutiny.
Because the stories get streamlined over time, but they're so different one from another when you get kind of the original brute reports.
Yeah. And you know, so just a for instance thing is like, you know, the John Mack, Bud Hopkins, Dave Jacobs stuff, where they're saying, you know, a large piece of evidence that this stuff is actually happening is that all these people tell roughly the same story about their being abducted. Well, you know, they wrote books about this and then people came and sought them out. So they were aware of what the framework was for these abduction stories before they went through, you know, hypnosis with them. So there's a lot of like, well, they took all these precautions and they use all the, you know, that's fine. But when you have a book that's out, or somebody has a book that's out that describes what they think happened to other people, like there's no way that doesn't infect the way that you're going to be telling your story.
Do guys like Bud Hopkins spend much time explaining that Betty Hill's alien had big nose, spoke in a British accent, and didn't know what vegetables were?
Yeah, it's weird. And the whole thing, like, these aliens, like, seem very sophisticated about some human matters, but then don't know what the word yellow refers to, or don't know what squash is, or, you know, it's just weird.
Like, to me, it seemed like Betty Hill's experience sounds a lot like my experience with an imaginary friend when I was a kid. You know, I go around the kitchen explaining to my imaginary friend how a toaster works and, you know, what's in yogurt. You know, it's kind of makes yourself feel smart. And Betty Hill's account often sounds like that to me.
Yeah. And I think the other thing about her sort of description of how everything worked is that it's definitely like somebody from 1961's idea of what a futuristic thing would look like rather than what a futuristic thing actually would have looked like looking at it from our time. Like, you would have thought there would have had like scanners and like MRI type machines or whatever. They wouldn't be like scraping off pieces of skin or
Or picture books about star maps.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I was talking to somebody who is like a huge, like definitely 100% a believer in it. And I was just like, you know, how do you account for that? How do you account for the fact that the spaceship sounds like something you would see on, you know, Twilight Zone back then, rather than something that was actually from an advanced society based on what we know from being like a little more advanced now? I said the best thing that I personally could come up with if I was a believer was that when sort of confronted with something that was sort of beyond your comprehension, that you sort of fall back on what you know. And that so your memory is you're sort of making substitutions of stuff that you can comprehend for stuff that you can't. And that was the best thing I could give, because in some ways, just the description of the spaceship in and of itself just seems like, well, like clearly this is a project. It's a product of her imagination.
Except it would make perfect sense that Mark Wahlberg is from outer space.
Yes. Yes. And I'm not disputing that claim.
Okay, I got a few questions to finish off on. I've been asking this to a lot of people in my tour of the United States. I apologize if it sounds like Canadian arrogance or whatever, but are Americans inherently paranoid? Is there something about American culture that makes them more paranoid than other people?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. I guess I don't know how paranoid like people in Austria or Finland or, you know, Zimbabwe. Yeah.
Because you do get UFO abduction stories elsewhere, but they seem to be particularly resonant in American media. And it seems to attract particularly people in the United States to make grandiose claims that, you know, we are being watched, monitored, experimented on by people from outer space.
Well, I think there's a big combination of things. You know, I think historically the U.S. has been conspiratorially minded. I mean, I think you go back to the founding of the U.S. and that was the case. I was going through some really, really old books that had been passed down through my family, and amidst like different Bibles and the tenets and, you know, practices of the Methodist faith from the early 1800s, I found a book from, you know, the 1820s or 1830s that was basically like, it was worried about Catholics, like Catholics coming over and like turning our country over to the Pope, and we'd be run by the Pope, right? So this is back then, like that was the conspiracy. And then I think, you know, I think post the Kennedy assassination, I think it's just one thing after another where it's revealed that, you know, the government's up to stuff that we don't necessarily know about and is not necessarily good for us. You know, you talked about MK Ultra before, but, you know, the Kennedy assassination and Watergate, and then you have the Church Commission, you're finding out what's going on with the CIA and what they've been doing with, you know, our tax dollars to undermine foreign governments. So I think there's just a variety of things that made you sort of question, like, what do you really hold on to as being, you know, truthful, and who can you trust to be doing what they say they're going to be doing or working your best interest, when we've sort of been shown time and again that that's not actually what's going on. But again, I don't know. I don't know if people in other countries have similar ideas. I mean, there must be conspiracy theories in general, and you can think of, you know, in different places, there's certainly conspiracy theories around, say, AIDS, right? That the different places like think it was a product of the CIA, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, but that's an interesting question. And that was a very long-winded answer.
which is fine. What's your favorite X-Files episode?
Gosh, I think it's probably one of the ones, you know how there's like basically two strands. There's like the mythology strand, and then there's the monster of the week strand. And there's one with the mythology where they they finally kind of explain what happened with Mulder's sister, and you kind of see where the Smoky Man kind of fits in with the Mulder family. And I think maybe that had the good combination of both sort of the sci-fi UFO stuff plus the, you know, government conspiracy stuff kind of merged there in a way that I think at the time I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, I actually enjoyed one. I don't think it's a monster episode so much as more of a paranormal thing. There was an episode with Bryan Cranston called Drive. And it's this yes. neo-Nazi guy who has something in his head or some pressure that if he doesn't keep driving westward at like 100 miles an hour, his head will explode. And it's not so much the story. It's the fact that Bryan Cranston discovered the character for Breaking Bad, I think, when he was doing that show. Apart from the neo-Nazi stuff, you know, because before that, he was this kind of, you know, Malcolm in the Middle, right? He was just because this very lackadaisical, stupid father, kind of a Homer Simpson. And then he transforms himself in a very different actor. And I think the X-Files allowed him to completely change his direction, his career. And I think I came to really appreciate Bryan Cranston from that particular episode. And there was the best line in the world was when Mulder turns around and he says, "On behalf of the International Jewish Conspiracy, I'm afraid to inform you that we're almost out of gas."
Nice.
Anyways, it had nothing to do with aliens, but I like that one. Finally, what's the coolest thing about living in New Hampshire?
New Hampshire, for a small state, has just got a lot of like cool sort of natural stuff going on. So we've got like we've got 18 miles of ocean coast, but it's all beautiful. There's the White Mountains, which you went through. We've got a really nice lakes region. I think there's like a lot of natural beauty, and it's all fairly close to it. You know, you're not having to drive.
Is there still no sales tax?
There's no sales tax.
Awesome. Love the outlets.
We've got the outlets. Yeah, it's a weird, you know, New Hampshire's got some weird aspects to it, but it's also got some like really sort of beautiful things you can do here.
It's like a little northern Texas.
Interesting.
In the sense that people like their guns and their freedom.
Well, in some places, you know, I live in like the southeast corner. It's like it's pretty liberal. Like it feels like sort of more of a probably like a Boston suburb, although we're a little bit far away for that. But they're more, once you get north, like once you get up to the White Mountains and above, and like most of the rural parts of the state, are more conservative. I mean, we're pretty purple. You know, we've got a Republican governor and two Democratic senators, but one of our senators is going to be in a tough election. So we're really one of a handful of states that's genuinely could go either way politically.
Okay, as opposed to the People's Republic of Vermont next door, which is like one step away from China, according to some people.
Yeah, I think that can get a little exaggerated, but yeah, their political culture is definitely, I mean, it's where Bernie Sanders is from, right?
Hey, I love Vermont. So. It's actually, the political culture is very similar to Quebec there, so it's not that I necessarily agree with the political culture in Quebec, but it's familiar, so I like going to Burlington. I got one last thing, if you're game. I got this thing called the question jar. These are questions that I've written down like 2 years ago. I don't remember what they are. Are you game to answer a question with the question jar?
Sure, of course.
Okay, here we go. What is the best concert ever?
That I've seen or just
that
ever?
You've seen or been to, I guess.
Oh my God, the best concert I've been to? That's a tough one. I went to a Radiohead show like 3 or 4 years ago. That was great. That was the best one I've been to recently.
Good. Are you a big fan of Radiohead?
I didn't know any of their tunes really, except for a couple until I saw them. And then after I saw them, I became a Radiohead fan.
This was in Boston?
Yeah. I was at the TD Center. It was fun. It was for my buddy's 50th birthday. A whole bunch of us got tickets and went. It was a good time.
Okay. For me, it was actually Rush 1991 Montreal Forum. I think it was like being on board a mothership There were lasers and smoke and big dancing bunnies. And there's only three guys on stage making an awful lot of noise. It was amazing. And I was, what, 19, 20 at the time? Stoned by osmosis.
Wow.
And I had a seat right near the pit. So I was actually really good seat. So after that, I didn't even want to see a concert anymore.
Yeah, I saw Metallica in Montreal on that island.
St. Alan's Island.
Yeah, yeah.
Near the big dome there, the big
right.
geosphere. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was good?
That was pretty fun, too.
Is that the one they did in the rain?
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I was very wet. I was trying to eat a hot dog and the rain just like washed the bun away. So I was just left holding a hot dog.
Just a sausage.
Yeah.
A wet sausage.
Washing it down with a Molson. So yeah, we had a good time though.
Oh, that's good. Well, I hope you come back to Montreal at some point. And if you do, I'll take you out for a real hot dog or maybe a smoked meat sandwich.
All right. That sounds good.
Thanks, Toby. I will be in touch with you. And I really hope that we can delve deeper into the flying saucers and all that.
Sure. Yeah. 100%. That'd be fun.
That was bonus episode 6.5 of the Paranoid Planet podcast. It was brought to you by the amount of essential vitamins and nutrients that your body can draw out of a deep-fried ding-dong. Contact us at paranoidplanet.mail@gmail.com if you have any comments, questions, or wild-eyed premonitions to share with us. And check out our website at www.paranoidplanet.ca for related readings and videos, blog essays, our episode archive, our theme song contest, a voucher code to order my Kennedy assassination book at a publisher's discount, and, maybe, a star map of the Zeta Reticuli star system, where you can travel to find Betty and Barney Hill enjoying the afterlife with the intergalactic space lord Xumfrilsdorf 55. On behalf of Joanne Lijo and the whole Gagné family, this is Michel Gagné saying, keep your eyes on the skies, keep your cash in your pockets, eat lots of fruits and vegetables, and don't even think of stepping onto that roller coaster if you want to live long and prosper.
Live long and prosper.
Live long and prosper.
Hey, live long and prosper, motherfucker.
Merci beaucoup. Live long and prosper.
May all your future gazebos live long and prosper.
Please leave.
Live long and prosper, Sheldon.
Yeah, even that. You look like a dork.
This episode was a Burden of Proof media production. We'll see you next time.
Conspiracies, paradigm shift, and critical thinking.